put together some of the ideas involved in Rosh Hashanah in such a way that we can understand something deeper about the day. Can you turn it down another job? No, put it on one, it'll be okay. Let's see if we can try and understand something deeper about the day. It gives us also practical handle on what the work of the day should be. So everyone's aware that Rosh Hashanah is a new year, right? That's the beginning of the year, first day of the next year. But in Torah thinking, we never have things that are simply a sentimental reminder or revisiting of something that happened before. The concept we have of time, our concept of time is that it cycles through, it's a cycle of energy. That time is a system in which what the world calls time, we call dispositions of energy such that when you move through those time zones, you could experience those energies. That's a fundamental thing to understand about the deeper level of Torah. We never revisit an event in such a way that we sentimentally sort of recall what happened then. That's not the idea. The idea is that we revisit that event because we become critically aware that at that moment in time, whatever happened then was possible. And if it was possible then, it's possible again now because we're in the same time zone. There's a mystical idea also that it's not only a circle. Time's not just a cycle where we revisit a point. It's actually a spiral. Because when we revisit... You okay? When we revisit... I didn't say anything exciting yet. When we revisit that point in time, what we're doing is visiting it at a higher level than we were the previous time we cycled through that, because we have a added level of development that we've worked on in the previous cycle. When we say Bayamim Hahen Bazman Azeh, what do we mean in those days at this time? It's not poetry. We don't have anything in the prayers or in the davening or in Torah that's just poetical. When we say Bayamim Hahen Bazman Azeh, those days at this time, what we mean is in those days in that generation, but at this time of year, that miracle happened then because it was this time of year. Pesach happened when it happened because the energy of Pesach was in the air. We don't celebrate Pesach now because it happened that at that time of year they went out. So at that time of year we celebrate Pesach. Pesach happened at that time of year because it was possible at that time of year. We know that Avraham Avinu ate matzah. He served matzah to the angels who visited him long before there ever was a Pesach. Right? He served matzah because it was Pesach. There wasn't yet the going out of Egypt. There was no Jewish people yet. But the point is that that time of year demands matzah, whatever matzah means. And therefore he was sensitive to that. He was sensitive to the time. He knew that redemption was possible then. At Purim, certain miracles happened. At Hanukkah, other miracles happened. Hanukkah happened then because that was the time of year. Now, if that's true, we have to understand what's the energy of Rosh Hashanah so that we can revisit it and do what we're supposed to do on the day. You should know that we never have a sentimental... You know that... The secular world celebrates birthdays. Birthdays. That's the anniversary of the time you were born. So we don't celebrate that. The only place the Torah mentions that is by Paroi, Pharaoh, who celebrated his birthday. But the Stei Chemed, one of the great commentaries, says that a person should be aware of his birthday. In fact, he should be aware of the date on which any miracle happened to him or any special event happened. Because if something special happened to you and being born, you know, is the most significant of all the things that ever happened to you. So if it happened at a certain time, it means that the time was pregnant with that energy. That kind of thing that happened in your life happened on that day because the constellation of spiritual forces came together on that day together with you such that that thing materialized, crystallized. So if you're sensitive to it, as you cycle through your own personal days, you should be aware that you can do certain things again on those days. Certainly a day like Rosh Hashanah where everything happened. Rosh Hashanah, the world was formed. Let's see if we can use that idea, the energy of that understanding of the energy of formation of the world, formation of the human being, and understand what we could get into on that day so that we can make that happen again. What needs to be understood is the fact that it's the beginning of the year, the fact that the same day happens to be a day of judgment. What does judgment have to do with creation? What does judgment have to do? I might have thought that new creation has to do with chesed, with kindness, not with din, with severe judgment. Why is the moment of creation the moment of judgment? Why is the moment of judgment so critical that the whole year goes off to that day? Do you know what judgment means? Din on Rosh Hashanah, judgment on Rosh Hashanah means that the way you judge that day, that's how you are the rest of the year. You can't move from there. You can move, but it's extremely difficult. It's much easier to set up your... Yes, it's like having to... If you are at any familiarity with the legal profession, you'll know that it's an awful lot easier to be acquitted than to be convicted and have to have the sentence commuted later. Yes, you're in trouble. If you're already on appeal, or you're already appealing to have your sentence commuted, yes, you are in a lot more trouble than before they pass sentence on you. Of course, you're in a lot more trouble then than if you never had to go to court in the first place, which is what you're supposed to try and do. You get to Rosh Hashanah without any blemishes, so that your name isn't on the court, you know, the list of summonses. That's the wise way to handle it. But if you already have been summoned, then you better be sure that when you get there, you've got enough merits that they acquit you. Right? Now, the point is that the day of judgment is a judgment that, after it's passed, the rest of the year is a question of trying to twist and turn and duck and dodge from a sentence that's been passed already. So it's an incredibly critical day. It codes for what will happen the entire rest of the year. Why is that so? Why doesn't Hashem judge us every day? Each day, the way you are, He looks at you and gives you the dispensation that you need. Why is it one day, the first day of the year, according to that you're going to be the rest of the year? How much you're going to earn that year, your financial thing, the suffering you'll go through, whether you'll live or chas v'shalom die that year? That's all coded on that day. It's a very agonizingly critical day. What does all this have to do with the davening, the prayer that we, on Rosh Hashanah, the unique prayer of Malchus, Zichronus, and Shofarus, where we say the prayers of Malchus, meaning establishing Hashem as king, Zichronus, the concept of memories, going back in memory to significant moments in the history of the world and the Jewish people, and Shofarus, blowing the shofar. What on earth does blowing the shofar have to do? What on earth does blowing the shofar have to do with all of this? What does it have to do with judgment? What does it have to do with his memory, with making Hashem king? Why is it that the merit of the shofar could save you on that day? Why is that mitzvah connected? Matzah on Pesach, understand what matzah does. A sukkah on sukkah, you have to understand what a sukkah does. How does a shofar do on Rosh Hashanah what Rosh Hashanah needs? What's it got to do with new creation? These are some of the questions that we like to try and answer. So let's see if we can lay down a wonderful spiritual principle that's an incredible principle for life to understand, and see if we can understand its application here. Rosh Hashanah is the beginning of the year, so mystically, we always try, spiritually, we always try to penetrate to the core. We try to penetrate to the root of what the thing is. And if we penetrate accurately to the core, then that concept that we've identified as the root will explain everything. Make sense? If you want to understand the way a human body looks, so you could trace it back to when the child was a fetus developing in his mother, that would give you insight. But if you could trace it back to the genes, where the genes were formed, so then that would be the most compressed and most primordial way, right, root way of understanding this person. If you knew how to read genes, right then you'd be able to say this child has blue eyes. And blue eyes are not going to be changed. And the shape of his nose and the color of his hair and the shape, all that's going to be coded in the genes. And in Torah, what we always try to do, we try to penetrate through to the genes of reality, because there you're holding everything. If I'm master of the genes, I can tell you things that you may not even be able to see with a lot of effort later. Rosh Hashanah so happens that if you hold the genes, not only can you see, but you can change. You know how to change the genes. A minute change in the genes can have far-reaching consequences. You want to make changes later, you're talking about brutal surgery. The thing to understand is that Rosh Hashanah is the genes of the year. It's the genetic material. It's the flash of conception of the year. Let's try and understand that. The mystical principle is that the closer you go to the root, the closer you go to conception, the more critical and the more all-encompassing. The more each millisecond becomes critical. If you get back to the first millisecond, you'll find that everything is there. From there on in, it expands and slows down and winds down. How would we understand that mystically? Well, take the example we used. If you take a human being, make a change, make a scratch or a cut in a person. Well, quite a large cut might not do too much harm. Do that size cut in a fetus that's developing, much more far-reaching consequences. And make a flicker of an adjustment in the genes, that could have the most unbelievable consequences later. The moment when the genes are swimming into focus is by far the most critical moment. After that's been done, are you with me? After that's been coded, after the genes have swum into focus, the genetic material has crystallized, the child is now coded for, he's going to look like this, he's going to be this tall, this color eyes, this shape here, this much intelligence, okay? These and these features of health or otherwise, etc. After that, all you're trying to do is manipulate the given. But if you could be there at the moment of crystallization, and as the forces come together, you organize them. So then you've organized everything. The moment of conception is always the critical moment. That's why, that's actually, in that moment, not only is it critical, but it's all-encompassing, everything's contained. The principle is akoyel, heilech, achar arosh. Everything goes after the head. Everything goes after that instant of conception. The first flash of something is always everything. The flash of inspiration in my mind to do something, right? The motivation that I have that blasts into conscious energy. From there on, it's just nerves. Nerves are firing, muscles are twitching, but that's animal, that's a machine. The way the nerves twitch and the muscles, yes, move, it's just a revelation of what that all-encompassing, incredible moment of motivation was. That determines everything. That's the human, that's the dimension of meaning, that's everything. The rest is mechanical. And it takes a certain amount of energy, a certain amount of space, a certain amount of time to carry out. But the core of it is what happened in there. If you want another example, when you think, how does inspiration go? How do you get inspired? Doesn't it always start with an incredible blinding flash of energy in which everything's all encompassed and all contained? Isn't that right? Is that right? You work around for months, let's say, having to solve a problem. Hours, days, weeks, whatever. You've got to become inspired about solving a problem or running some sort of project. Is that right? So you walk around not knowing how you're going to do it. Suddenly, and usually when you're least expecting it, you get illuminated. Right? With a flash of inspiration about how you're going to do that thing. It's so fast that you haven't even got time in the moment of inspiration to actually see what it is. And yet you still know that it's all there. Are you with me? You only start dealing with it the second afterwards. The second afterwards, and already the dust starts to settle and it begins to dissociate, differentiate itself in your mind, where you actually see how wonderful it really was. But even in that moment, you're already aware that the entire solution, it's an incredible mystical moment. Are you with me? The first moment of inspiration of a project is so potent that you know that you have it, you know that it's correct, you know that all the details are there, even though there hasn't been time to see any of the details yet. It's a transcendent moment of ecstasy. That's what it is. That's why it's so happy. That's why it's so ecstatic, because it's all there. After that, it's a question of housekeeping, that's all. After that, it's a question of letting the pieces fall into place and get each one organized and polish this up a bit and readjust that a little, and then let them find their way into action. But all the process of organization and action is none other than just a coming into being of what that incredibly compressed moment of inspiration was. These are very, very hard things to find words for. But if you've ever lived or thought or had an inspiration or solved the problem, you'll know that that's the way it is. Isn't that so? You solve a problem in mathematics or in human relations or something, suddenly you get smacked between the eyes. That's the solution. That's the solution. Why are you saying that to yourself? You haven't even had time to examine it yet. Is that right? And yet, but you know it's all there, it's perfect, it's fine, the ecstasy is there, there's no problem about it. Now you have to go and do it. Rosh Hashanah is the moment of conception. The way you are that day, you're living in the genes. And the next 9 days are the pregnancy of the year. The first day, Rosh Hashanah, is 10 days. The first is the day of conception. Everything's laid down there. The 10 days, Rosh Hashanah expands into 10 days till the critical moment of Yom Kippur, which is the birth of the year. The fetus is swimming into shape. The genes are busy playing themselves out. The child's starting to develop. Still a fetus. Still hasn't been born yet. Still not a person in the revealed world. There's still a lot of manipulation you can do. But it's all been coded for by the first day. If this principle is understood well, you understand why people take Rosh Hashanah so seriously. It's not just another day with another energy that other things happen. Rosh Hashanah is everything. If you come right on Rosh Hashanah, you'll have a perfect year. Perfect. Absolutely perfect. If you function on Rosh Hashanah perfectly, if you master anger perfectly on Rosh Hashanah, the rest of the year will be fine. That's the critical moment. There are people And of course, you hold strong as you can for 10 days. There are people who take on stringencies in Jewish law. They do things more exactingly than they do normally in those 10 days, even though they know they're going to drop them after Yom Kippur. But it's sincere. Because you want to live in the higher mode, what's called Batama Elyon. You want to live at the higher mode, at the higher level for those 10 days. Why? Because you know what? If you live at that moment, you will not drop them. You may drop the technicalities, but the, once you've fired up the engine, okay? Well, you know, some Bale Musa say it's like sending a rocket into space. When you send, let's take a modern idiom. When you send a rocket into space, what happens is the energy you put in the beginning. After that, it's just a coasting along. And you know what? It coasts along at unbelievable speeds. But it all depends on what you put in the beginning. Do you know what kind of energy it takes to get one of these Saturn rockets into space? The energy is stupendous. It's unbelievable. I don't know if you know some of the technicalities. But when one of those rockets is fired, the energy, the millions upon millions of pounds of thrust are so enormous that the sound energy alone, the acoustic energy, which doesn't do anything for the rocket, is so intense that they have six foot diameter water pipes. Do you know that? Pouring millions of tons of water onto the exhaust nozzles, okay, to save the concrete buildings from being smashed by the acoustic energy. You know that? That's just the sound energy of those rocket engines, and the sound doesn't do anything. There's nothing compared to the energy that's useful at propelling the rocket. The unbelievable amount of energy that those rockets need. Why? To break gravity. But once that energy has been done and the thrust has been given, those rockets coast at like 20,000 kilometers a minute or something, or an hour, whatever, with no energy at all. Are you with me? The momentum you build up, that punches through, that's what it does. Rosh Hashanah is even deeper than that. Because in Rosh Hashanah, you're not supposed to put in energy that lets you coast. Rosh Hashanah, you're supposed to generate a nuclear reaction. The trick is, see, people who think that you can do it, raise yourself to that level so the spark is fired and the explosion happens in Rosh Hashanah. That's a bad mistake. You know what's going to happen? The rest of the year, you'll be a black singed scar. What's left over from where the explosion burned out. That's what will happen. That's not the idea. Rosh Hashanah is not just lighting the fire. Rosh Hashanah is lighting a fire that lights a bigger fire the next day. That's what it is. It's like a self-sustaining, what do you call it in nuclear physics? Critical mass or something. What? A chain reaction. A chain reaction. It's where all you've got to do in a nuclear reaction, you've got to generate, you've got to detonate an explosion big enough that it detonates a bigger one, and then you can sit back. Okay, are you with me? That's not coasting. That's what Rosh Hashanah has to be. It's not just doing it for one day. It's doing it so powerfully on one day that the next day is going to be even more. You've got to become such a new individual on Rosh Hashanah that you'll be a new individual the next day more than that. That's the level. That's a critical mass you have to reach. That, by the way, is the story of Jewish life. You know, the first man who put this into the world, who formed us into what we are, was Abraham Avinu, Abraham. And how did he grasp his own existence? He said, "V'anoichi afar va'efer, I'm dust and ashes." I'm dust and ashes. What's dust and ashes? So if you think poetic, you know, very humble. Very humble. Dust and ashes. But there's nothing poetic in Torah. It's much more than humility. What it means is this. You know what ashes are? Ashes are the bare elemental remains of what, when you burn a thing entirely, when you take a thing apart, you know, in biology or in medicine, when you want to know what a biological material consists of, you ash it. You expose it to incredibly high temperature instantaneously, and what happens is it dissolves into a pile of ash. That ash is the elemental content of what the thing was, with none of the interconnections. That's all that's left. Avraham Avinu told Hashem, "You know what I am, Hashem? I ash myself from minute to minute. I take whatever I've become, every moment, I ash it entirely. And then you know what I do? I take the bare elements and I make them offer the soil from which a new me grows. And as soon as it grows, I ash it again and I grow a bigger one." That's what he was doing. He was doing it from moment to moment. Halavai, we should do it, you know, once a day, once a year. How about once a year? Once a year, you should maybe, you know, take everything that you have become, dissolve it into its ashed elemental components. You know what the elemental components are? They're just a memory. Listen to the word memory here, Zichronus. They're just a memory of what the previous existence was. Ashes is something. Ashes is not nothing. I remember he didn't say I destroy myself entirely until there's nothing left. But what I do is I undo all the connections that have become habit. All the things that have ground themselves down into things that are accepted already as existence, I take them apart and reassess them. And I re-put them together. And then the new element, the new thing becomes new ash elements. And those become a new earth from which a new plant grows. That's dust and ashes. That's a new existence. It does not mean that once in his life he became new and then he coasted along for the rest of his life. That's not called being new. That's called dying. The mystics say that if you're here today because you were here yesterday, that's called dying. You have to be here today because you got born today. You have to be here today because you recreated yourself today. Not because you rolled on from yesterday. That's not being alive. How do you see this?
Well, when a mother receives the seed for making a child,
she doesn't keep it in her body as a seed.
She keeps it, what is a seed that she receives, a woman who's able to do this?
It's always women who are able to do the building.
Men can only put in the inspiration.
Now, you have to learn what it means to be able to inspire, put in inspiration, and then make it happen.
She takes that spark, a woman, and what does she do with it?
She gives it just enough, she gives it energy so that it can, what is that spark? It's a potential to become a person.
She doesn't keep it as a spark, that's potential. She starts making it happen. And as soon as that cell becomes two cells, they have the ability to become four. And when they're four, they become eight. And when the child's a little fetus, and the mother lets it grow, until it painfully has to separate, in pain and danger, it separates from her, but she does that too.
And are you with me? What a mother does in growing a new reality, she doesn't take something and nurture it as what it is, maintain it, maintenance. We're not talking about maintenance. We're talking about giving it rocket fuel so that it can become something new that can become something newer. That's what it is.
When a person teaches somebody else, a Rebbe who knows how to teach, he does not teach a person how to be what they are at that level. He doesn't raise them to a new level that they're supposed to stay at. He's supposed to give them the tools to go beyond that level till they get beyond him.
The whole of Jewish living is chain reaction. It's always starting a seed that can become more seeds.
Are you with me?
That's what seed is. A tree doesn't give a seed that becomes another tree that becomes another seed. A tree gives thousands of seed and they become thousands of trees and they become millions in the next generation. There's exponential growth. That's what life is.
You know, the Jewish attitude to life is that every moment is an ashing of the previous moment and turning it into the soil for a new growth, right, at this level. One of the most incredible ways you see it is when you talk about the transition in Jewish terms from past to present to future. When you talk about that, the way we say it, unbelievable idea, incredible. If anybody wants to understand the spiritual meaning, just to see behind the curtain, just a glimpse behind the curtain into what Torah is, all you have to do is examine one or two Hebrew words, that's all. Just understand exactly, just a little bit, what is the words of Lashon Kodesh, what's Torah saying, compared to any other language. And there couldn't be the faintest shadow of doubt. Let me give you an example. When you say in English, you say, where have you come from? And you say, where are you going? What does it mean? What does that sentence mean? It means, where did you come from? Where were you previously? And where are you heading? What else does it mean? That's it. You know what it means in Hebrew? Listen to this. Unbelievable idea. If you become sensitive to this, you'll never be the same again. It's impossible to live the same once you've heard this idea. When we say in Hebrew, where do you come from? We say, me'ayin bata. Me'ayin bata. From where did you come? And where are you going? We say, ana telech, or la'an. Ana telech, to where are you going? But you know in Hebrew, the words me'ayin, from where do you come? You know what the words literally mean? You come from nothingness. Ayin in Hebrew, ayin. Ayin means there is nothing, is not, is nothing. Me'ayin bata means, colloquially, loosely, where did you come from? Literally it means you have just materialized from nothingness. And ana telech, where are you going? Ana telech, the word ana in Hebrew, is such a potent expression of longing, of desire for another dimension that there's no word to translate it in English. You know, the way it's conventionally translated is please, but it doesn't mean please. It means, like we say, ana Hashem Hoshiana, Hashem Redeemer, send the redemption. We preface that with the word ana. It's an unbelievable, inexpressible word, okay, trying to express the longing for a dimension that we can't even perceive how great it is compared to this. By the way, those words, ayin and ana, are transpositions of the basic root ani. The word in Hebrew meaning me, selfhood, myself, is ani. Rearrange those letters, you get ayin, is nothingness. In other words, incredibly, what it means is like this. Ayin is nothing. Rearrange, that's the past. The present, ani, is me. And I dissolve in the ana of the future. In other words, what you have to grasp is this. In Hebrew, when you speak to somebody, you grasp existence in such a potent way that the person who is now is as if they materialized out of nothingness. The present is so potent that it makes the previous second seem like total nothingness. It's ashes. And that now is compared to the next moment in such a way that you can't even express the proportion. And Hebrew does that. The person walked out of that room and they're walking out into the garden. That's all. Nothing more dramatic than that. And when you speak to them, you say, may ayin bata, you come from nothingness. And Anatelech, you are going to a dimension that exceeds this in inexpressible terms. What a language! What a language! You hear that? I mean, Because why? Because the total grasp of existence is that any moment is a something from nothing. You know why? Because it is. Where's your past now? Where's your past? Where exactly is your past right now? You know what your past is? That's an incredibly ethereal, ephemeral swirl of something called memory in your head, that's all. Show me the rest of it. Where exactly is your past? Where's everything you've done? Where is it? It's just a faint, isn't that ashes? All that's left of your past is the barest elements, just the faintest impression that's circuiting around in your circuits of memory. And your future, where's that? Certainly not here. Are you with me? All you are is the transition between dimensions. That's all you are. You're the explosion. You're part of the chain reaction. And if you grasp it correctly, so you're the moment of explosion that causes the next explosion to be exponentially greater than this. But if you grasp it wrongly, so you're a slowly decelerating, rolling on, until you finally roll out energy entirely. Rosh Hashanah means getting into the chain reaction and getting it going. That's what it means. That is why it's a day of judgment. That's why it's a day of judgment. Judgment means, din means, such self-generating perfection that you can afford to stand in judgment on Rosh Hashanah. You dare not stand in judgment any other day. Once you've got the situation with your habit patterns, where you're running out of energy, where you're rolling downhill, yes, the last thing you want is to be judged there. The only time you should be prepared to be judged is when the new energy is coming into focus. Because at that moment, the mystics say there's no Yetzirah. You know that? You are not subject. You cannot be subject to the forces of evil. You cannot be subject to your own disintegration, your own drive to materialism and to pleasure and to the lower self. You can't. You're not subject to that in the moment of new creation. Yes? You're not subject to that. Because when the energy is flashing in, it's so pure and it's so energized, there's no time. You see, the Yetzirah only works when things are expanded into time and space. The dimension of negativity only works in the tangible material world. The interface with the spiritual, when the new idea comes in, there's not yet any tangible time or space. Are you with me? If you get very small in time or in space, if you interface with the infinite, at that flash in, let me try and give you an example. Let's say you're walking around, you need an inspiration. And that incredible millisecond when your brain lights up and you get that voltage that runs through your body, right, that you know you've solved the problem. Is there any negativity in that moment? Is there any despair or worry about it not working in that moment? Is there any concept that maybe it's not right, maybe it doesn't fit together? Of course not. That happens in the next second. That's when it starts there. After the energy is flashed in, then you start to get worried. You think, I'm a fool, I could never do that. That's too ambitious, that's too big, I couldn't do it. That takes too much energy, I'm too tired, I'm too lazy. Are you with me? But you don't think that in the moment of inspiration. The moment of inspiration, that moment, the moment of beginning, when there's no possible Yetzirah there. The Yetzirah cannot creep in. The Yetzirah only creeps in when things start to run a groove, run a rut. Right? The mystics say that the concept of running into a groove, that's symbolized by a circle. You know that idea? A circle. Perfect circle. It's the only shape known to man. The only shape conceivable that has no unique feature. You know that? Any part of a circle is the same as all the others. There's no beginning, there's no end. And any little segment is the same as any other segment. And the tiniest segment, if you continue it, you'll definitely, that's all you need. It's already predictable from the smallest amount. There's no other shape like that. A straight line, you don't know where it'll end. Any other shape, you don't know where the next bend will come. Only a circle is that. You know why? Because a circle is a symbol of continuity. It's only continuity. It has no new spot. It has no speck of beginning. You know that in Hebrew, the letter that symbolizes that is Samach. The Samach in Hebrew is a perfect circle. And you know what? When the Torah talks about beginnings, when the Torah talks about, you know, in the Parsha of Bereishis, which is the beginning of man, the beginning of the world, in the Parsha of Bereishis, in the Parsha of Bereishis, there's no Samach. You know that? In the whole chapter of Genesis, pages of Chumash. There's not a, you try to write a couple of pages in English without an S. Huh? The letter Samach does not appear. The first time it appears, says the Midrash, is where woman is formed. Because woman is the letter of continuity. Woman is the concept of being able to. But of course, woman's continuity is to continue newness. That's the perfection of woman. Not just to continue what was old, to continue newness. Samach appears only where continuity is. The whole Parsha Bereishis. There's another Parsha in the Torah. It doesn't have a Samach either. If you look through it carefully, you'll see it. The whole Parsha of Bechor, the firstborn.
there's only new beginnings. And the whole parsha of Bechor, therefore, of the firstborn has no summer. Actually, the Or HaChaim, I think, points out that also the parsha of the Menorah. The Menorah, the light that shone from the Mishkan, from the Beis HaMikdash, which symbolizes Torah, has no summer either. And 2 weeks ago in the parsha, I happened to notice that the parsha of Bikurim, the first fruits, also doesn't have a summer. There's no accident, these things. Always newness is a concept that's pure newness. If in the moment of newness you bring in boredom, and you bring in the maintenance, the rut, the habit-forming things, you've had it. If that's your Rosh Hashanah, do you know that some people have a custom not to sleep on Rosh Hashanah? It's a deep mystical custom from the Arizal, that people, at least the morning hours of Rosh Hashanah, at least the morning hours, until after midday, because that's when the acute judgment is taking place. You want to be judged asleep? You want to be judged ticking over? That's how you want to be judged for the year? You want the genes of your year to be laid down while you're in a state of oblivion? That's how you want the rest of the year to be? You understand what's going on? They want the year to be laid down. They want the judgment of the year, the genes that are going to code for that. They want that to be laid down in a moment of explosion. So that the next day will be a moment of explosion that generates. Not, they don't want the genes of the year to be laid down, you know, in total unconscious oblivion in the world of dreams, which is the world of unreality. That is some part of the concept of why Rosh Hashanah is judgment. You are being judged at the moment of newness. There's a deeper idea as well, and that is that the world is formed in judgment. And since Rosh Hashanah is the day of the creation of man, Rosh Hashanah, on the 25th of Elul, the world was created. On the first day of Rosh Hashanah, man was created, man and woman. The sixth day of creation, that Friday, is the day of Rosh Hashanah, we say, Ayom Haras Elam. On this day, the world was given birth to. On that day, man and woman were formed. So it says that Hashem originally wanted to create the world in judgment. Are you familiar with that? It says in Chazal, Alaba Machshava, it came up in Hashem's mind to create the world in strict justice, strict din. That means everything exactingly to the thousandth degree. And then it says, Ra She'en O'elam Yiskayim, Hashem saw that a world couldn't survive like that. Hashem saw that if you have a world of strict justice, human beings couldn't survive. So he added rachamim, he added kindliness, he added the concept of giving you an extension, a chance to do tshuva, and it's another chance, and it doesn't exact payment and retribution at once, he gives you time, etc. So the conventional, again, you have to understand that din, creating a world in justice, judgment, means that you judged exactingly without any quarter given. It means if you do one thing wrong, you get destroyed immediately. Absolutely immediately destroyed for the slightest infraction of Hashem's command. That's what justice means. And a human being couldn't stand up to that. So Hashem saw that that wasn't possible, and so he made the human being that he had a little more leniency, a lot more leniency. But the obvious question is, but Hashem didn't know that in the beginning. What, he had a bad idea? He had an idea to create the world in justice, and then he saw, you know, back to the drawing board, didn't work. You have to understand, why does it say that Hashem first wanted to create the world in justice, and then backtracked and added rachamim? The mystical principle is like this, it's a beautiful, beautiful thing to know. Whenever it says that a thing was supposed to be a certain way, and then it was decided to make it another way, it means that the way it really is the first way. The way it really is the first way. Only laid on top of that, without destroying it in the least, is another dimension as well. But the way we'll finally be, the way life is really meant to be in the world, the perfection of life is living in judgment. And you know, in the next world, in Tchias HaMaisim, when the dead are revived, it will be a world of justice entirely. There'll be no world of chesed. There'll be no giving second chances. It'll be judged exactly and we'll be able to stand up to it. You know the second bracha in Shmona Esrei. The first bracha is chesed, Avraham Avinu. The second is gvura, Yitzchak. Yitzchak Avinu. Total, absolute, iron, rigid self-control without any quarter given. That's Yitzchak. What's the bracha? Chaya Meisim. Hashem will revise the dead. Revise the dead into a world where life is the way it should be in reality. Rosh Hashanah is the day when the world is formed the way it should have been. Whether you see chesed operating, whether you see people laying on top of the din, their own free will, and it looks like we're manipulating and maneuvering, you should know underlying it is din functioning 100%. It never gets bent. The Gemara in Sukkah says, again, once you've heard this, your life will never be the same again. The Gemara in Sukkah says like this, you want to see how din operates when it looks otherwise to you. You want to see when what was meant to happen happens, even though it looks to you like you're manipulating it. The Gemara says like this, one day, Shlomo HaMelech, King Solomon, he saw the Malach HaMavis. Spine-chilling story this. He saw the angel of death. Huh? The Ka'ati, which means he was sad. The Malach HaMavis was walking around sad. The angel of death was walking around miserable. So Shlomo, you have to understand this. This is not fairy stories. This is a Gemara. This is Torah.
So Shlomo Melech, King Solomon, the wisest of men ever, he went up to the Malachim and said, why are you sad? What's the problem? And I said, you know, I've been sent to the world to take two individuals. And he said their name. I've come to take the souls of two individuals. And I can't take them. I just can't get them. Shlomo heard the name of those two people. They were friends of his. They were two very beautiful people who were friends of his. And as soon as he got this inside information from the Malachim, he decided to save their lives. So he had certain spiritual forces transport them immediately to a town where no one can die. To a town called Luz, which is a town in which the Malachim Avos cannot enter. In the town of Luz, the Malachim Avos can never take in the Shomer. So he transported them instantaneously to that town. And you don't see anything about it. As they got to the gates of the town, they both died before they could enter. So the next day, Shlomo saw the Malachim Avos walking around happy. He was smiling. So Shlomo went up to him and he said, what are you so happy about today? And the Malachim Avos said, you know those two individuals I told you I was sent to get? You know what? You know why I couldn't get them yesterday? Because my instructions were to take them at the gates of Luz and I couldn't get them there. You hear that? So here the wisest of all men trying to do what a person's supposed to do in the world to manipulate the world. And what happens? It ends up exactly the way it was supposed to be. Exactly the way it was supposed to be. You have to make your effort. You have to do it. Of course you had to try to save the knowledge. You should have sat back and done nothing. Of course you make your effort. You think Hashem's playing it your way. You think he's playing it your way. You think you're playing it your way. That's justice. Underlying the conduct in the world with all your effort is, that's the thing we can't understand. That's from the roots of the deepest mystical secrets that we cannot understand. We can't understand it. But that's the way it goes. And that's Rosh Hashanah. That's the day when the world looks the way it is. And on that day you better come right. On that day you better be, that's the day when the world's set up in judgment. And on that day, you don't start backtracking and manipulating. You're not even allowed to say Bidu on Rosh Hashanah. You know that? You don't do Tshuva on Rosh Hashanah. Rosh Hashanah is a day for Tshuva. Yom Kippur is a day for desperate, last minute, last ditch Tshuva. Elul, the whole month, you're supposed to be coming right. But when you enter Rosh Hashanah, it's not a day you start saying, Hashem, I've got this mistake, and this problem, and that problem, and start working it out. Rosh Hashanah, you just put on your face. Rosh Hashanah, you just are perfect without undoing. Some say that Rosh Hashanah is like going to a photographer, and Yom Kippur is like going to a doctor. Instead, you're a photographer, you cover the scars, you put on the face, you stand there, you look pretty. Okay? Afterwards, you know, you melt down. Okay, after the picture's been taken, you go to the surgeon, you have the cosmetic surgery done, so it like really looks that way. Rosh Hashanah, Rosh Hashanah shouldn't be putting on a face because the judgment's too deep for that. Rosh Hashanah, you have to look perfect. Okay, you have to really be perfect. That's what you have to. You want to be judged on Rosh Hashanah in absolute perfection. You want to reach the level. You once said there was a man who said an angry word the day before Rosh Hashanah. One day before. It was that night, and the next night was Rosh Hashanah. In the days of the Tanoim. So he was so distressed to see that anger came out of him that he realized he wasn't perfect, and he had only one day left. You don't fix anger in one day. It's much too hard a job for that. And he only had one day left. So he was desperate. So what did he do? He says he went and slept in the cemetery that night. Spent the night in the cemetery. That'll fix you. Okay? Spent the night in the cemetery, okay, with alone, yes, and there were no lights over there. Okay? You know, things start to move in the night over there. There's lots of things start to happen. And that reminds you very painfully of where you're headed. So that could knock the wind out of your sails, you know, when you're sailing in the wrong direction. That's what he did. Of course, it's not recommended because the side effects are heavy. The side effects of that are that you might knock the wind out of the sails and might not sail again after a night like that. But he was desperate and he was able to take it. They want to say that it had the desired effect. He merited to hear certain people talking. He was buried over there. He heard certain people talking. In case you want to be really terrified, what did he hear? He heard, for example, two girls talking. Two young girls who died when they were young. They were talking to each other. And he heard them saying, he heard the one girl saying to the other one, pass the comb, pass my brush, pass the makeup. Another one was saying, pass the lipstick, pass the... They were talking, and he suddenly realized that here are two people in a world where there's no face to put makeup on and no hair to comb, and all they can think about is physicality. In other words, they lived a life that was so physical that that's what they became. And when they move into the world of reality where there's nothing physical, all they can relate to is the physical. So they're experiencing non-experience. They're experiencing non-existence. What they're condemned to in the next world, okay, is to be moving in a world of physicality where there is no... Can you imagine the pain of that? I mean, in case you want to know what it means, the night before Rosh Hashanah and judgment and what this man was doing and what he learned. We try to shed the physical, so that you enter the zone of judgment spiritual, so that when you enter the real world, which is all spiritual, so you don't have to have any of the dust shaken out of you, you've already been, you're already tuned to that world. person who spends his life in this world in the gymnasium trying to build his body, yes, till he looks like a gorilla. If that's his last goal. So in the next world where there's no body, all he built was the body and none of the mind, none of the neshama. In the next world where all he's left with is the neshama and he didn't leave any of that, and the body that he worked on is taken away, so what's going to be? And that is why we daven Malchios Zichronos and Shefos. Malchios means we make Hashem king. That's exactly the work of Rosh Hashanah. When a man was created, Hashem was king, and man was a servant. And that's the way it was supposed to be. It says, Adon Olam, king of the world, right? Master of the world. Asher Malach, who was king, who ruled. The Terem Kol Yetzir Nivra, before anything was formed, he was king. Right? And after man is formed, after everything's done, after the whole history of the world is, what will be? Azai Melech Shmo Yikra. Then his name will be called king. But he was king before, and he's called king after. So we try and get things back to the way they're supposed to get to. We try and do that in Rosh Hashanah to really get them there. We try and set up Hashem being king the way he should be, the way the creation began. Zichronus, what's memory? Isn't memory going back in time to the point of perfection? What is Zichronus? We remember the creation. We remember the giving of the Torah. We remember, we go back, not sentimental memorizing. It's going back to those points in time. How powerfully? So that you experience it. How should you experience it? When you go back to Sinai, for example, you're supposed to experience it so powerfully. You know, the Ramban says, Yiyeh Einenu V'libeinu Sham Kol Hayomi. Our hearts and eyes should be there all the day. That means you should never have left Sinai. We're a generation that, unfortunately, our parents, grandparents, great-grandparents, etc., somebody along the line left Sinai. And we're trying to fight our way back. It's hard for us. It's hard for us in this generation. But that's not what the Jewish people were until two, three generations ago. Until three generations ago, they never left. The Pasuk in the Torah, incredibly, says, Hisham alecha ushpun nashikha ma'od, pen tishkach es advarim. Guard yourself very carefully, lest you forget the things the day you stood at Sinai and met Hashem. It doesn't say remember, it says don't forget. When somebody's forgotten, you say remember. When somebody remembers, you say don't forget. Are you with me? Don't forget means I expect you to be there remembering all the time. Don't forget it! Not remember it. You should be in a place where you know it so intimately you never left there. That's what we should be doing. That's how we should remember it. And remember the creation, remember Sinai. Zichronus is going back in memory. In case you want to see a little more deeply, I'll just say a hint. Zichronus, the word zikaron in Hebrew, meaning a memory. Listen carefully, I don't want to say too much. The word zikaron in Hebrew is the same numerical value as zero, meaning a seed. Memory takes you back into the phase of having ashed everything into its bare elements. That's what zikaronus is. Actually, if you want to think a little bit more deeply, the word zikaron and is based on the word zachar. Zachar, a memory, and zachar, the male, are the same thing. Because the male dimension is just giving the seed. That's what it is. It's going back into the phase of inspiration. Of that brilliant moment of flashing in of the genes. That's what Zichronus is. Going back to that level where there's no Yetzirah, where everything's formed perfectly. That's what the depth of Zichronus is. And finally, Shofar. What is the Shofar? Why does the Shofar save us? But the mystics say, we'll finish with this. The mystics say that the Shofar is the root of speech. Speech is words. But the root of speech is voice. We want to go back to the core, to the genes. The genes of speech are the raw voice itself. On Rosh Hashanah, what we want is, we want to cry out to Hashem with a voice that doesn't have any words. Words are too late. Words lie. Words always lie. Words are finite and fragmented, and they're loaded with all your nonsense. Words are hopeless. All you can do is utter a sound that's not perverted and contaminated by the words. You've so prostituted and so contaminated the words that you've used, that you can't afford to use those words. Because they're so dripping with contamination that Hashem, that the spiritual world is going to say, what? You're going to use this tool that you've contaminated, you're now trying to get through to me with that tool? You've taken speech that I gave you to speak to me, and you've contaminated it, and you have the audacity to use the tool that I gave you to connect with me. That tool that you used to do exactly what you shouldn't, you now want to use that? Are you with me? A man shows a woman a sign of love. He gives her a token of his love. Yes? What? That woman now takes that token of love. And not only does she not value it, not only does she give it away, she gives it to somebody that she's being unfaithful with as a token of closeness. Isn't that compounding? Yeah, what's happening? That which should have been the sign of closeness has now been used to be disloyal. Speech, which is what distinguishes the human being, what makes you human, what makes you spiritual, is your speech. And you've taken that and perverted it. And now you want to use that to speak to Hashem. Hopeless, no one's going to listen to your tefillahs. By the way, that's why when we dub in Shmoneh Esrei, at the end of Shmoneh Esrei, after you pour your heart out and you say, Hashem, save me. Give me this, give me that. Do this for me, do that. Then you say to yourself at the end, you say, Yilu Ratzon, and then you say to yourself, whoa, 1 second. I've just been speaking to Hashem with these words that I've sullied. So you know what you say? Lokai Nitzar Lashoni Meira. Fix up my speech for me. I'm so ashamed that the only way I can get through is to speak. And my speech is useless because I've so damaged it. So you put in a pathetic plea at the end of your Shemoneh Esrei to fix up the tool so you can again use the tool. So on Rosh Hashanah we go one better than that. We say to Hashem, listen, our speech to you, yeah, our communication to you is so riddled with disloyalty, right, that it's just hopeless. You know what we're going to do? All we're going to do is cry. We're going to take a sound that's a raw sound that's not yet contaminated, because a cry, the sound of the voice crying, right, the raw broken sound of crying where there are no words, that's a pure sound. You know what the halacha is? That the shofar must sound like crying. Either like gasping cries or like moaning cries, but the shofar has to be like crying. Because when there's a cry, then you hear what the person really means. When a person's crying, and when you're crying, you can't form words. Dissolves. When you're crying, all words dissolve into the root idea, which is the sound. You know that the Hebrew word bechi, which means crying, is the root is mevocha. Mevocha means to be lost on the road. To be have no direction, to be completely lost. That's what crying is. All dissolved. The word tear, by the way, dema in Hebrew, meaning a tear. The root is dema, which means to be totally mixed. Mixed in, sacred and profane, mixed together. That's dema. Tears and crying are dissolution into total loss. Total, absolute, directionless. That's what it is. Or that Hashem could hear. That Hashem could hear. The shofar is the sound of crying. That's what it is. The shofar is the sound of the scream of a child in the night. If you've ever heard that sound, you know exactly what it means. You don't need any words. Words would only confuse. When you're in a moment of agony, okay, when you're in a moment of absolute, abject, raw terror, okay, you do not compose words. In a moment like that, all you do is you scream. That's sincere. That is sincere. There's a famous Hasidic story about the little shepherd boy. To understand the depth of these stories, little Jewish shepherd boy in the hills, who was never given any education and no one to teach him since the first moment of his consciousness, he was watching sheep in the hills. He had nothing, he had no Jewish learning, he knew nothing about Torah. The only thing he could do was whistle for his sheep. He had a special whistle that the sheep understood. And he used to whistle and the sheep would come. And one day he was tending the sheep in the hills. And he saw everybody dressed in white walking along the road. So he went over and he said, people, where are you going? And the people said, don't you know, it's Yom Kippur. It's Yom Kippur, we're going to Shul to daven to Hashem to forgive us. And he felt the call, he felt that he had to be there. So he followed the people and he went into Shul and he sat at the back. And he saw everybody with his siddurim, davening and davening and davening and speaking to Hashem and asking Hashem, save us and bring us the good and bring us the redemption and give us this and bring us close to you. And he couldn't say it. He couldn't read the words. He didn't understand the words. He couldn't. What did he do? He let out a whistle, a sheep whistle. A loud, shrill whistle in Shul. Everybody turned around, the kids disturbing the service. And the rabbi said, that sound got through. Your prayers, not so sure. But that whistle got through. That's a very beautiful sentimental story, but the depth of it is, but the depth of this is what's trying to be conveyed here at the sound of the shofar. That wordless cry, that's just a sincere expression that I have to connect with Hashem. Yes? Yes? At all costs, even if I can't find, I don't have words. Yeah? That wordless cry, that whistle, that sound of the shofar, that's what it is. And that's, of course, why the shofar is voice. Voice comes from the root. Words come from the lips out. The teeth, the lips, the tongue, they form words. The only deeper level than that is the breath, the soundless breath, which comes from where the heart is and where the lungs are. That's called neshima, the breath, which is the same as neshama. That's a very similar word, where the soul comes from. But the first root of expression is the voice. And that's why it comes from the throat. The throat is always, and that's why whenever the Torah talks about prophecy, it doesn't talk about words of prophecy, it talks about voice of prophecy. And Hashem says to the prophet, go and speak to Yerushalayim. Krav begaroin, call out in your throat. Al tachsoich, do not hold back. Al tachsoich. It does not say cry out in your mouth. It says cry in your throat. Your mouth not good enough. Once you're saying words, people will get you wrong. Don't say words. Say the voice. Say the thing itself. Don't talk about it. Say it. When Sarah tells Avram Avinu that Ishmael is no good, he must be separated. Ishmael is no good. He must not be together with Yaakov. Listen carefully to that. He must not have a place in the same country as Yaakov. He must be separated from Yaakov. Avram Avinu sent him out far away to the east. Didn't invite him in and give him autonomous place to be. I don't say too much. But the point is, he sent him away. What's happening politically is a different story. I'm not saying it mustn't happen, but it's a tragedy that we've got to that. After Avraham Avinu put 3,000 years of separation into our history. So now that had to be undone. Now, he especially sent Ishmael away so that there should be no contact between us. He didn't have little children on some lawn of some building, holding hands. And but when Hashem said to Avraham Avinu, listen to Sarah. He did not say, listen to her words of wisdom. Listen to her words. He said, Shema b'kayla, listen to her voice. When prophecy speaks, what you hear is the voice, because the voice is the thing itself. That's what it is. We should all be zoicha this Rosh Hashanah. We should be able to reach the root of our neshamas, right? We should be able to undo all the schmutz and nonsense and contamination that's on top of all the layers that we keep putting on top of ourselves. We should be able to get back to that root. That's a complete exposing of the neshamah. Stand there on Rosh Hashanah, whatever wordless way you can. Say to Hashem that this is, whatever you want is okay, and I'm yours. But form me the next year the way you want. Let this be a day of reformation. Let it be a day of recreation. Let's go back to that moment of creation, okay? The day has the power to recreate entirely, no matter what you are and who you are. No matter what the problems, no matter what the fractures in your personality. Man was created on this day, okay? He was created from absolute nothing. There was a nothingness before, it was an iron before, now it's a yesh. Let's go back to that situation. This is the day it can be done. You have to live like that for one day. And you have to live like that so sincerely that the next day will be even more of that. If you do that, then there's no limit.